I think consumers and also retailers are really interested in regenerative, which is part of the reason why we made the transition. But I think there's a lot of confusion about what regenerative means. I think a lot of retailers and consumers assume that regenerative is organic. And that's not always the case for a lot of folks. Regenerative might just mean conventional plus cover crops and then some chemicals to kill the cover crops. So we think that in addition to organic being the baseline for regenerative, certification is essential to help build consumer trust and hold the industry accountable for meaningful change.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
When I go to the grocery store, I'm looking around to see if there's any farm stories, and you know, you're seeing them anymore. Well, my guests today are farmers. They've been farmers originally, but they got their name on packages of product. They got their name on rice, and I've just purchased some. I'm going to talk about it. You're my lunch today, and I'm really happy to welcome Bryce and Brita Lundberg. Hey, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you so much for having us, Roger.
Yeah. It's a dad and daughter team here. You're both Lundbergs, and you're in a company that you've got that's heritage in farming, and you've got packages in the grocery store that a lot of farmers have dreamed of. You know, there's different ways that you try to keep going in the farming business, and some have to look at vertical. But the way vertical has worked oftentimes in the past is top down rather than bottom up. It's maybe some processors that thought they had to take over being farmers or control farming more and more. And those stories of farmers that are able to go vertical and have products available and be able to get them into and merchandise them through grocery stores, there's not as many of them out there as one might hope there are. But you are. Lundbergs are.
We are. It's a long story of just a family from one generation to another. And starts with, you know, grandparents going through the Dust Bowl back in Nebraska in the 30s and deciding it's time to start again in California. My grandfather, Albert, was 50 years old when he started over in California. He brought his four sons, and my grandma, of course, a flatbed, 1933 flatbed Chevy and a tractor on the back, and said, it's time to start over. And came here to Northern California to a little town called Richvale.
Crucially, I think he also brought with him a new philosophy. You know, based on his experience of the Dust Bowl, he decided, you know, we're going to do things differently in California. We're going to work in partnership with nature, not against it. And in his words, leave the land better than we found it.
You know what? That's so key. And I guess after I heard about this story of yours, it made me think how now there's some argument. Some people in agriculture say, well, wait a minute, agriculture is not broken. The food system's not broken. But wow, if you go back and look at the Dust Bowl, that was a people could experience it firsthand. Now, it just so happened, my mother's side of the family had left Illinois farm, and they thought, oh, let's try it out there. And they went out to that area of Nebraska, pretty close to the Colorado line, and it was horrible. And they came to the same conclusion your family did, but I think they maybe turned the wrong direction, at least for real estate appreciation. They went back to Illinois instead of going on to California. Your family then goes off to California after that experience. And what brought them to Northern California?
Well, my grandfather had a brother here. You know, my grandfather, his dad died when he was 10. So he stopped going to school at the age of 10 and started farming. His older brother moved to California probably around 15, 17. So he would visit his brother out here. And I think he finally realized it was better out here with his brother, where his brother was farming, than where he was farming in Nebraska. And of course, there was irrigation out here, Roger, right? They were just dependent upon the rain. And when the rain didn't come, there were no crops. And they're just fortunate to have a community that could depend on itself and a banker that would carry them from year to year. But out here in California, there's irrigation. And you could have dependable crops when you could grow a crop of rice. Rice got started here around 1915. And so rice had already been grown here for close to 20 years when my grandparents came here.
People always wonder about that when they hear that you're growing rice, because they know that water is involved somehow in producing rice. And that's something we're short of in California. You point out we had irrigation, but rice doesn't work just anywhere, does it? I mean, do you have to have a certain kind of soil?
We do. We actually grow rice here in Northern California because we have this super heavy adobe clay soil that holds water like a bathtub. It has like 0.00 inch per hour percolation. So the water sits on top of the soil instead of sinking into it.
So it's heavy clay, and down about 2 feet to 3 feet, there's hardpan, compressed clay and sand that prevents really water from percolating. The initial settlers here thought they'd be able to grow all the crops. They could see crops grown close to the Feather River, mm-hmm. and up here close to Butte Creek where Bidwell was growing. And the inference by the land sellers was that you could grow anything here, but they soon found out you couldn't. But fortunately, USDA was studying rice here, and those that didn't leave and stayed because they were too poor to leave were able to start with rice. And so we came here my grandparents came here to grow rice.
So let's talk through that a little bit. There's a lot of my listeners, including myself, I shouldn't just say my listeners, aren't that familiar with the cycle of growing rice. Now, you've explained the fact you need some water, but you've got this hard pan and you've got this clay and so forth. But what's the typical year? I mean, what do you have to do to prepare the soil? And when are you doing things like planting and adding the water and all those things? Could you just give us a quick walk through that cycle?
Well, rice is planted in the spring, it grows in the summer, and harvested in the fall. So toward the end of March and hopefully by mid-April, you're in the fields and are preparing the seed bed. And one of the reasons we also grow rice here, it is super flat. It is flat as a pancake. And so you're working a seed bed. And once the seed bed is prepared, and you want to have a flat seed bed, and you'd like to have the clods, and because it's clay, it's pretty cloddy ground, but you want the clods to be smaller than your fist. In fact, you'd probably like them about half the size of your fist. And then the last thing we do in preparing a seed bed is we'll want to kind of put a roller across it that just packs it a bit and puts a little bit of a corrugation shape on it, so that when we then we'll put water on, we'll flood the field, and then we fly seed on. The seed goes on by airplane, soak seed, and so it sinks right to the bottom. And we want to finish planting before the 1st of June. So we'll be planting pretty much from like May 10th to May 30th.
Sometimes May 45th.
You don't want to plant in June, so it could be May 45th, sure. That planting by air, you soak the seed for 24 to 48 hours, and then you drain the water off, and that just primes the seed to grow. It's like pre-germinating the seed. And so it's water imbibed, so it's heavy, so it sinks to the bottom. If you've got a bit of a corrugation on the bottom of the seed bed, it's going to fall to the bottom of that corrugation. You'll see fields that are starting to grow. It'll look like you planted it by drill seeder, because it looks like it's in rows because of that corrugation. But the rice is primed to grow, and the rice seed will take off once it hits the water.
So once you got the bed, was it, I don't know, was it something, a plowing and disking or something that you're, before you're rolling it to get the ground ready, and then you add the water before you put the seeds in?
We do. For the most part, there are a few varieties that we will seed by ground, but I would say 95% or more of our rice is seeded by air.
There's a lot of people in the country, they're going to scratch their head right there, because you never hear of planting by air. So you got airplanes flying over, and you're dumping rice seed into that area. That's incredible.
They'll dip and dive over the fields and crisscross the country roads around here, and it's like straight out of North by Northwest, if you've seen that classic Hitchcock film. So sometimes they'll fly straight at you, which is very exciting.
Brita, you had a North by Northwest experience last spring, didn't you?
I did. I was trying to get a video of planting for our social media channels, and I got the video, but almost, you know, lost my head in the process. Not really. But
the pilot was having a little fun.
You're not like Cary Grant that was able to roll in the dust and still go to a hotel.
That's right.
Wiped the suit off and was able to go from that scene where the duster was trying to take him out. I don't know where they got a plane like that, actually, in Indiana. There were very few of them, but they supposedly that's where he was. So,
well, you know, the seeding by air, though, is for our organic system is really valuable thing, because it primes the seed to grow. If you planted dry seed, the rice would still have to imbibe, and then it doesn't have the seedling vigor. It wants to get a breath of air. And so if you take the water off to give it a breath of air, you're going to give all the weed seeds a breath of air too. And our ability to try to manage weeds in a rice, an organic system, all is about managing water and keeping the weed seeds covered while we keep the rice seed covered. And that's what we're going to do first for the first 30 days, is work at managing the grass weeds with water. Try to drown them.
We have super hot, dry summers here in the Sacramento Valley, so we're lucky that we don't have to deal with a lot of disease or pests. So our primary challenge during the growing season in the summer is weeds. And there are two kinds. There are the grass weeds and the aquatic weeds. So first, we drown the grass weeds. We raise the water level just high enough to drown those grass weeds without killing the rice. And it's a super tight window. We've got about 24 to 48 hours where the grass weeds will die and the rice will survive. So we have to be out there checking the rice, reading the rice, we call it, to make sure the fourth leaf of the rice plants gets through the water and gets a breath of air.
Wow. But the fourth leaf of the grass needs to stay under the water and drown.
That's right.
Wow. Boy, I'm learning something. That's true. So that's amazing. So, and then when it starts growing, what all do you have to do to it between then and when you end up harvesting?
Well, then we've got to deal with the aquatic weeds, right? Because we've got all that water on the fields. The aquatic weeds are living their best lives, just loving it.
The bulrush, the duck salad, the lilies, they're all loving it. And they're just kicking in about 30 days. And so because it doesn't rain here in the summer, we can predictably dry the fields up. So we dry the fields up for about 30 days. The fields stay dry. They stay so dry that, and you could drive out there, the weeds going to dry up.
The ground will crack almost. You can kind of stick a pen in the cracks in the ground. It'll get so dry. And the rice will look like it's dying. The weeds will die. But the rice can survive, again, just a little bit longer than the weeds. And so so then we put the water back on and it rehydrates and comes back to life.
It rehydrates so quickly. But all the while you're drying it up, the roots of the rice want to stay with moisture. So you're getting a really nice developed root structure that when you put the water back on, it rehydrates mm-hmm. so quickly, and that plant at that stage is going to feed in a really large area of your soil structure.
Mm-hmm. Boy, talk about working with nature. I hadn't really thought about that, how rice outcompetes the other grasses and the other kind of weeds, and it can survive, and you can actually go through a tough stage where it doesn't die, and it, mm-hmm. it survives. I'm wondering whether that stage, whether that contributes, makes any impact on the nutrition of the rice. Because for a lot of products, including good wines, mm-hmm. getting really close to having a pretty high stress. Has there been anything done on that?
It
is a really good question. Those are two major stressors on the rice plant. It's a good question, Roger. You know, I would say that there are benefits to that drying up. When it's completely dry, the methane production is a lot lower, and the rice isn't picking up arsenic when it's dry, and so our rice tests lower for arsenic. But those are not necessarily benefits as far as good nutrition. It's less of bad things.
But there is, and I didn't even know there is some methane that is produced in the process.
Well, rice grows in water, and so there is a concern about methane production in rice, and so the taking off of the water. There's been some study that talks about that, but you're much better.
Yeah, it helps reduce greenhouse gas potential by 49% relative to continuous flood.
Wow.
We funded a study in organic rice production at UC Davis. Mm-hmm. So it was a UC Davis study.
So let's just take a quick, let me see what the alternatives look like. So if you're talking about organic production in your system, what's the non-organic look like with side by side when they're getting rice to that stage? What it is that's happening in a field that's not organic compared to what you're doing that is organic?
Well, generally speaking, you know, the preparation of the seedbed is a lot the same. One of the big differences is that in organic systems, you know, as we would continue to work through the calendar or the system, is that once we get to the fall, we will plant cover crops on a lot of our fields, and so there is the whole angle of working in the cover crop mm-hmm. In the spring, and that looks very different.
Mm-hmm. So whereas a conventional farmer might be using synthetic fertilizers, we're relying on the cover crops that we grow during the winter to provide a lot of that natural fertility to the fields.
Yep. We also bring on other natural fertility, usually coming from chicken or turkey operations in California. But we rely heavily on the cover crop. Mm-hmm. It's like feeding a diverse diet to the soil.
Green juice for the ground.
It's kind of like green juice for the ground.
That makes sense. I interrupted your season, though. So we've got the rice growing, and let's go back into finish it on up through harvest. What's happening at the end of the season, and when is it that you actually harvest the rice?
Well, after the dry up, we put water back on for about 30 days, and then the rice is, because it's such heavy soil, we'll want the fields not for the water to be off about 30 days before harvest, so that the fields aren't bone dry, but they won't be muddy. So then, so rice is about a 130-day crop. So the first fields planted will start harvesting toward the end of September or early October, and then harvest through October. Hope to be done before Thanksgiving. That would be our goal.
It's a combine that mm-hmm. goes in just regular.
Yep, it's a green combine. Our combines have tracks on them instead of tires for the most part, just in case it rains. You know, in 2021, it rained 7 inches during harvest, and you know, so I think it was like around October 15th, just cut loose. So it was just a muddy mess, right? But so you have to have tracks just to be ready for that. Mm-hmm. The rice is harvested at, we're looking at color and moisture. We're looking at a moisture, and then the one, you want to see that the color is right, especially for those brown rice varieties. You want to see that the bran layer is turned brown. And then we bring the rice into our granary or our rice dryer, and we want it dried down to 14 to 15% where it's stable. And we're going to clean it so all the chaff and straw and dust is out. And then we're going to mill to order all starting in the fall and winter. And of course, we sell rice to retail, and you got to have enough for your customers. So if you run out, you're going to lose your space on the shelf.
Sure.
After harvest, there's the straw that you want to know what you're going to do with the straw. And when my grandparents came out here, they were committed never to burn their rice straw. So we've never burned our rice straw. Most farmers don't burn it now, which is great from an air quality standpoint, mm-hmm. and from a soil health standpoint. Some still do, but most don't. So we're going to, on about on a portion of our ground, we're going to grow cover crops. I like to say a half the ground, but it depends on the year. We're going to put cover crops in. That's oats. It's a small grain and a legume mixed together. And then half the ground we're going to flood for birds. And that's a great relationship that rice has with the Pacific Flyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, tell that story. And is it something that you wouldn't have to do, but that you're doing it because it is good for birds? How did that come to be?
Yeah, so our farms are part of the Pacific Flyway, which is a major migratory pathway for birds. Each year, up to 1 billion or more birds travel the Pacific Flyway. But the wetlands that those birds depend on, that habitat, have been disappearing for decades. Today, 95% of California's wetlands are gone. And so each winter, we flood a portion of our fields to help replicate California's natural wetlands, to provide food and habitat for thousands, if not millions, of migratory birds as they pass through. And they just go to town in our fields, picking up leftover rice, but also putting that nutrient-rich rice straw into contact with the soil, which turns it into mulch for the next year's crop. And they also eat weed seeds, which is really helpful for organic farmers like us. And so it really is a symbiotic relationship. And then, of course, our cover crops that we're growing during the winter also provide great nesting habitat for ducks who have lost a lot of their nesting habitat. They will often nest and lay eggs in our cover crops. And so each spring, before we start our tractors to prep the fields for planting, we partner with our friends at California Waterfowl to carefully tread into the fields and rescue the eggs by hand and transfer them to a local hatchery where they're incubated, hatched, raised, and released back into the wild. So we've been doing that for about 30 years now, and we've rescued more than 30,000 eggs over those years. And again, not something that we would have to do, but we're growing those cover crops for the health of the soil and also to provide habitat for those ducks.
Well, so, they're very attracted to the cover crop. It'll be a foot to 2 foot tall at that point and provide good cover for them. And so we want to respect the work of those hens, mm-hmm. or the ducks, and save those eggs. Mm-hmm. Great partnership with California Waterfowl Association. They'll bring out a lot of volunteers so they can cover hundreds or thousands of acres as the need may be.
Well, and then those ducks in that off season, they're doing their job of fertilizing the soil a little.
They do.
That
we'll take
too.
That great.
Oh, that's a great addition as well.
And so then we bring it back then around full circle to the cover crop needing to be prepared, to mow the cover crop and then prepare the season again for the rice season in the spring. So we have gone first full circle there from spring through harvest back to spring.
So now we've got the crop grown and we've got this rice and we're going to market it. Tell me the family story that got you into actually processing your own rice and having your own brand and distributing it. How and why did that transition happen?
Well, in the late 60s, there was a company that, Bob Kennedy from Chico-San, he had a macrobiotic company featuring rice cakes made in Chico, was looking for organic short grain for his rice cake factory. And Preeti, you want to tell the story?
Sure. So he was looking for someone to grow organic rice for him. And, you know, it was still the very early days of the organic movement. So he asked a lot of farmers and they said no. But my grandpa and his brothers said, you know what? That sounds like our dad's advice to leave the land better than we found it. And I think they were most of the way there already. And so they said, we'll do it. And so in 1969, they planted their first organic crop. It was something like 76 acres, not a lot, but enough to convince them to make a go of it. And so soon they bought an old bread truck, filled the back with bags of rice stenciled with the Lundberg name, and hired a driver to stop at health food stores along the coast from California to Washington. And that was really the start of Lundberg Family Farms.
The thing they had to do, though, they had to build rice bins, mm-hmm. and they had to build a small mill, mm-hmm. Because they needed to be able to keep their rice separate. They had been part of the co-op and delivered their rice to co-op, but to do this organic rice business, they had to build their own bins and build a mill. Mm-hmm. And then they just packed in 50 pound bags, for several years. And then my uncle Eldon, your grandpa's brother, my dad's brother, bought a Foreman fill, I think probably around 1974, 75. He bought a simple, used Foreman fill, piece of equipment that would package rice, and they packaged two pound rice, and they started selling that to, you know, that one of their first really good customers was Safeway here on the West Coast, and brown rice, mm-hmm. short grain brown rice. Mm-hmm. They were convinced, Roger, that, you know, most of the rice in California was being milled to white and exported. And they were really proud of the rice they grew here, and they knew brown rice was better for you, and they wanted to introduce brown rice to customers here in the U.S. And of course, the organic movement was looking for organic short grain brown rice, and so that was the start of kind of having a package. We grow 17 varieties of rice, and so we do look for, you know, diverse, unique varieties. And in 1971, my mom and dad were Peace Corps volunteers to Brazil, and we lived in the Belém in the Pará, state of Pará, up on the Amazon. And boy, you could see diversity there. And mm-hmm. Dad saw varieties of rice that, you know, we had never seen before or didn't know existed. And he came home after our family's work there with Peace Corps and said to his brothers, there's a lot of varieties. And he started a nursery here at the farm to start developing new and unique varieties of rice to bring to the market as well.
So it's not just brown. So you've got all these other varieties as well. I'm a fan of brown because I've believed for a while. In fact, I was at some meetings a long time ago where there was some argument among rice growers that were defending the white rice and saying, oh, it's just as good as brown. And yet some of the people I was with, some of the nutritionists that were involved in that particular meeting said, oh, not so fast. And they had the story on why they thought that brown rice really made sense. But you've got something for everyone. So you've
You do. But, you know, rice grows, comes off the field when we harvest it as paddy rice. It has an outer hull on it. Yeah. And just if you take the outer hull off, you have brown rice. And then there's seven layers of bran and the germ. And you take the seven layers of bran off and the germ, and then you have white rice. And so there's a lot of B vitamins and fiber in the bran. But culturally, you know, I think we want to provide rice for every culture and for every kind of dish that you might find in a cookbook.
Sure.
And if it's calling for white long grain or white jasmine or an arboreal rice, we want to have that for our consumer.
Can I just buy that stuff you take off? You know, what happens with that? I mean, you've got the to make it white rice, and you're getting rid of all this that's really rich nutritionally that comes off it. What happens to that?
Well, it's really high in oil. It's 23% oil. So if you know you're getting rice bran oil, it's coming from the bran, of course. But because the point is that it's high in oil, so it's pretty volatile. It'll start to go rancid really quickly. And so if you want that product for food consumption, you'll want to come here and get it yourself the day it's milled and bring it home and put it in the fridge or the freezer so that the oils are preserved. Mm. Otherwise, it needs to be stabilized with heat right away. And we don't do enough here to stabilize. We do sell some bran, and the companies that want it come here with a truck to get it, and then they go take it right away to stabilize it. But Roger, we'd be happy to send you some right out of the mill. And
you know what? It's intriguing because there's several different products like that it's actually in the skin, the hull, and so forth. There's a lot of nutrition that gets missed. One of them is almonds that we grow a lot of. And the hull of an almond is used largely for cattle feed. The dairy cattle get a lot of it. But when there's some work being done at UC Merced right now that I've seen some of the preliminary research, and there's just incredible nutrition in the hull that they make take something with. Because when you get down to it, in the case of almonds, an almond is really a confused peach or an apricot. And the seed of an almond, it's actually the nut. But that outside area, which was the fruit, has a lot that, you know, again, the dairy cows are doing well off of, but probably we could too.
Well, that's where most of the bran goes, would be to animal feed.
Yeah.
They get that good stuff.
Well, that's good. Now, let's talk about this now. You've grown. So now in your operation, you not only have the plant, you have all these products you're producing, but you're able to get more farmers, so you've got more employees. I mean, you're not your grandpa's company anymore.
That's right. We, you know, and that's really because I would say it's been a wonderful partnership with consumers who have said, hey, we want our food grown this way, and we like what you're doing. We like to support a family business. So the mill has been expanded. It's still, I think, the smallest rice mill in California, but we've expanded it three times. And then in the 70s, my dad went to a food show and bought a rice cake machine right off the floor. And brought it home and said to his brothers, I think we can make rice cakes here at our farm. And today I think 300 rice cake machines popping rice cakes every day. So we make, you know, four different lines of rice cakes, from a traditional round cake to a square thin cake to a mini cake to a chocolate enrobed rice cake, and we pop those all here at the farm, and so it takes a lot of dedicated team members that come to work every day here to either grow rice or dry rice or mill rice or pop it, mm-hmm. pack it.
Or sell
write
and
stories market. About it.
Yeah, that's right.
and so it has grown. So we're continuing to innovate and try new things. We've tried a lot of things, Roger, that haven't worked. We certainly don't bat 1,000. We are probably batting 250, 300, but you got to try stuff.
Sure.
And sometimes a product will have a good response, but have a short life. Let's say one of those is our rice couscous. It was a good product for a long time or for a while.
We still get a lot of consumers emailing and asking how to make that couscous.
That rice couscous. Yep. We made chewy bars, a granola type bar. I sure wish we still made those.
I wish we made the hot cereal.
We had hot cereal for quite a while, but we're innovating now in the area of puffs, more types of puffs and, more different or unique varieties. And there'll be some surprises out there when it comes to flavors and offerings.
You know, I had some surprises when I went shopping and I decided I'm just going to pick up some Wungberg rice and bring it home and have it for lunch before I talk to you guys. And I did. And I got Thai Home Molly Brown Jasmine Organic Lundberg rice in this packet, which I like. I like these packets that you can put in the microwave and 90 seconds have them. But then I was surprised. It says imported from Thailand. And that really threw me for a loop.
Well, I can understand, Roger. You think, you know, you get a product with Lundberg Family Farms on it and that everything would be coming from our headquarters here in Richville, California. We believe in that, you know, that many of our current and future customers are going to want convenience items, things that they can cook or prepare in 30 or 60 seconds, 90 seconds. And that ready to heat rice is one of the ones that we want to be ready for and offer our consumers. It is hard for a company our size to interest or to engage with a company that'll make it here because we just can't get the quantities. They'll ask us for thousands of cases on minimum orders. And we've tried it before here, Roger, and the minimum orders we usually don't sell through where there's a lot of maybe wasted product if we don't. So we've gone to Thailand. We've had a relationship with farmers in Thailand. We've tried to have a collaborative relationship with farmers in the Chiang Mai, Chiang Rai area of northern Thailand. I've been there several times to see farmers, and they are a wonderful group of farmers that are growing in a group called TOFTA, Thailand Organic Free Trade Association. We have a relationship with a company called Grace Bio that helps organize them and get regenerative organic rice for us from that area. And so our hope is as we build that base of the ready-to-heat rice coming in from Thailand, that we'll get enough size, enough distribution that we can move that here to the U.S. and put our own rice from California in that package. But hopefully that package didn't disappoint you, that the product you had was tasty and good and fresh.
No, I like it. And I have to admit that I often add things to rice anyway. I might need some hot sauce or all sorts of things that I'll add to rice until I like piling things into it. But it was very good. I think it's very interesting because you had to get the scale to get up to that stage. Now, with this product, like these reheatables that you get, so is the rice actually cooked before it's put in these
packages? It is. It's cooked. It's cooked before and put in the package.
And then it's last. I don't know what the sell-by date on these things, but lasts for really ridiculously long time.
I believe that's an 18-month, about a year and a half.
So yeah, it's cooked rice. It's in there. And then that's why all you have to do is put it in the microwave for 90 seconds.
Yep. And you know, isn't that, I think, part of the direction that consumers are wanting to move to, especially they want to have that option. Because, you know, our brown rice will take 45, 50 minutes to cook on the stove. And I think a lot of people will do that. Mm-hmm. They'll cook it and then they'll keep some and put it in the fridge and refrigerate it and pull it out during the week or freeze it and bring it out themselves. And we do that at our house. We freeze it and then put it in the microwave. And it works a lot like that, ready to heat. But it'll save pretty much indefinitely in the freezer, already cooked. But that is an option that we think consumers will want, and we want to be there supporting that consumer that wants that rice.
Is it more cost effective to be able to, you know, cook it and package it in Thailand and bring it back than if you were trying to do it in the States at smaller scale?
I think it is more cost effective, especially in the area of reduced. We do smaller batch sizes, and then we don't have waste. You know, the most distribution companies are going to look at that amount of time you have on the best if used by date, and they're going to want to say you've got to have at least 75% of that date still available if we're going to buy it. And so you start looking if you had it made and you had a big run and it could still have over a year's worth of time available on that best if used date by date, but if only a few months have gone by, some distribution companies will say it doesn't have enough shelf life left. Don't ship it to us, and so that's part of what you have to deal with in these minimum run sizes for us.
You know, I think there's some people who listen to a conversation like this and scratch their head because they think, wait a minute, it's farm to table. Aren't we talking about local? But what? We grow 325 crops here in California that where your family originally came from up in Minnesota before they went out to Nebraska. You can't grow any of them. You know, and if you look at the places in the States that can grow almonds or rice or some of our other products, there aren't many places. It's going to have to be coming, you know, from some distance.
That's true. We grow it here on the West Coast, and we have customers all over the country. Some of our best customers are in the Northeast, right, in sure. The Boston area, and we're happy to ship them our rice.
You know, one other thing, too, is I would say California in its of itself is a brand, because even to be in agriculture in California, we've got more stringent rules and regulations for conventional farming than exist in other states. And I know there's other states that are producing competitive products to California, but they don't have the same rules of the Department of Pesticide Regulation and our state EPA and so forth. And so consumers really don't hear about that much, that there's just in buying conventional, it's different California than others. And then let alone to, in your case, to be organic and from California. And now we're going to talk a minute here about regenerative organic and from California.
You are right. California farmers, they do have, I think, a lot more hoops, a lot more restrictions, a lot more challenges, just as being a general farmer when it comes to air quality, when it comes to water quality, when it comes to Department of Pesticide Regulation. California farmers grow food the way Californians want it grown, and I think the way the rest of the nation wants it grown. And when it comes to rice, The highest quality rice buyers in the world come to California to buy California medium grain called Calrose because of the quality. And Brita mentioned it earlier. we have a dry summer here. And with a dry summer, we don't get, well, I'll maybe flip it the other way. Where you have humidity, you have disease and you have insects. And I think that for us, when it comes to rice quality, that is key. But I think that's also, you know, why you have such great almonds, or why you have such great vegetables and fruit and all that, is that we don't have, for the most part, all the challenges that come with parts of the country or parts of the world that humidity brings so many more challenges related to disease and insect.
Yeah. Well, and even the people that try to be organic growers have a harder time growing some of the crops that are trying to grow organic back in the Midwest, just because of the humidity. It's an uphill climb. And I know many people that have tried and just found it very, very difficult to be organic growers because of the humidity, and which you don't have to. But now let's kind of go to this next stage, though. So California's different, it's got some advantages, and then you've differentiated yourselves even more with your varieties, but the fact that you're organic, but now you've taken it another step, that it's not enough just to be organic, but you're regenerative organic. Now, that word's popping up a lot, and I'm having it in many of my podcast conversations. But where were you guys when you look at, you're standing there at the brink and say, look, we're organic, have we done enough? And the answer was, well, apparently not. Let's take it a step further and regenerative organic. Tell me about that.
You want to start, Bree?
Sure. So we believe that regenerative starts with organic. But regenerative hasn't been legally defined yet. So it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. You can ask, you know, 10 different people what regenerative means, and you'll probably get at least 10 different answers. But if you ask us, it starts with organic. And organic exists on a spectrum. You know, you can do a lot more than what the USDA National Organic Program requires for organic certification. But really that's a floor, right? You can do a lot more, but USDA NOP sets the floor.
And I think part of the regenerative organic movement has to do with the idea that the floor that the USDA set may be too low for some people. When the USDA National Organic Program will certify organic hydroponics, organic with no soil, and I think we believe organic production is done with healthy soil, and that you need to build your soil, and your soil needs to feed the crop, and that the soil is, of course, the living part of where the plants grow. And so that's why we've engaged with the Regenerative Organic Alliance, or Regenerative Organic Certification, is to take that step to say, we're gonna work up that spectrum and say regenerative organic is where we want to be, because we believe it's in soil. And then the other pillars are with wildlife or animals, and then social fairness. And those are things that that the National Organic Program don't necessarily engage. And so we don't own animals. We don't necessarily grow animals on our fields, but it's that relationship we have with the wild.
Oh, you've got ducks and fish.
That's right, ducks and fish.
Exactly, ducks and fish. And so we do want to say we do have a relationship with the wild animals, and provide habitat, and are going to care for them while they're here. And then we have to have a relationship with people. The farm, the people that work here, but then the farms that we work with about 25 farmers in this valley to grow the organic rice for Lundberg Family Farms. And we're going to treat them fairly, and the people that work here fairly. So those are the commitments we believe go beyond into regenerative organic certification.
I've been on some retail calls before. I mean, I think you must have too, when you're getting Lundberg into a supermarket chain and getting on the shelf. And boy, they're tough. I've gone in and I've not even been invited to sit down. Somebody just looked at their watch and said, okay, you got 10 minutes, start talking. And so it's a tough crowd. You probably run into nicer folks than I did, but I thought, man, this is not easy. But you have to come in with another product. You're trying to get it on the shelf. And how hard is it to explain to them that there's this additional value and persuade them that it's something that they should get on the shelf because they're going to have consumers that are going to want to have product that's grown that way and came from farms that were regenerative?
I think consumers and also retailers are really interested in regenerative, which is part of the reason why we made the transition, to be honest. But I think there's a lot of confusion about what regenerative means. I think a lot of retailers and consumers assume that regenerative is organic, and that's not always the case. For a lot of folks, regenerative might just mean conventional plus cover crops and then some chemicals to kill the cover crops.
It could be that they used to use six chemicals and now they're going to only use five. Mm-hmm. and say, well, that must be regenerative.
Yeah. And so we think that in addition to organic being the baseline for regenerative, certification is essential to help build consumer trust and hold the industry accountable for meaningful change. And so I think while a lot of retailers are really excited about regenerative, there's also a lot of education to be done around what that means, both with consumers and retailers.
It's an interesting process. I know here in California, we're in the process of defining for California. Mm-hmm. And on the outside, people outside of California kind of doing one of those, well, here you go again, California. You know, who made you in charge of this sort of thing? Well, the answer to that is nobody else was doing it. And so, you know, California is engaging because there's a lot of people that are like you that are looking into it and growing into it. And they're consumers and retailers are saying, explain to me, how is that, you know, what is this definition? What are we sticking to? And so it's a really, really interesting time to be mm-hmm. in that space, that as the market is growing, the definition and the understanding of it is in the process of being shaped, you know, simultaneously.
It is. I think that's going to be a big challenge. You know, there's a discussion about, well, should regenerative be defined for the big tent and have, you know, almost every farmer be able to do something small or something and be able to use that term, or should it be something that requires much more commitment and transition, much more investment and like Brita said, we believe regenerative is regenerative, starts with organic mm-hmm. and then becomes regenerative organic. And that's what we're committed to. And so we've joined the Regenerative Organic Alliance, and they offer regenerative organic certification. Mm-hmm. And we can't just do it all in one year. We're committed to having all of our organic regenerative organic certified by 2017.
That's right. Last year.
2027.
That's right. In 2023, we launched our first regenerative organic certified product, becoming the first U.S. grown rice brand to launch a regenerative organic certified rice. And we also set a goal to certify all the organic rice that we grow as regenerative organic certified by 2027. So we're making a lot of progress against that goal this year, but like my dad said, can't do it all in one go. So we have a ways to go.
You know, it's, you know, on our own farm, we started with our own farm, Roger, right? And our own production to go through that process of certifying regenerative organic certified. And then the next year we took all the family-related farms So, you know, we didn't really mention it, but Lundberg Family Farms is owned by 40 family members. It's a pretty extended multi-generational family farm. And some of the family members farm with the bigger farm called Lundberg Family Farms, and some farm their own ground individually. And so the second year, we ask for all those family members that farm their own ground to join the Regenerative Organic Alliance and get their ground certified.
So that would be like my dad and uncle's farm. And
you farm, Brita.
My brothers and I farm together. And so our farms are becoming Regenerative Organic certified this year because, you know, we partner with a network of about 25 other like-minded independent family farmers. And, you know, many of them we've been growing with for generations at this point because, you know, back in the day, they also wanted to farm organically. And if you want to farm organically, you need a relationship with a drying and storage facility and a mill that's able to process organic rice. And so we really were only able to grow Lundberg Family Farms together. But with this transition to Regenerative Organic Certified, we didn't want to ask anybody to do something that we hadn't done ourselves. So we started with Lundberg Family Farms internal farming operation. And this year, like my dad said, we're getting all of the family members' farms.
Well, we did that certified. In 23. Mm-hmm. And now we're asking for kind of all of the growers this year to say, it can be done. Mm-hmm. Here's how it's done. And then won't you make that transition with us?
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. And, yeah. You know, for a company that starts out with a goal of having the land be better than you found it, mm-hmm. you're actually walking the talk. and it takes a while and it takes a commitment. And I've no doubt there'll be descendants years down the road of the Lundgrens that will benefit too. And the consumers will on the land actually improving. So we don't go back to a dust bowl again, that we actually are finding what starts a few miles south of Chico, California, spreads all over, and many more will be doing it as well. And from Thailand to California and everywhere else you could think of.
It makes a difference. Brita, you have this saying about rice. Rice is a plant.
Yes, it grows in the ground. And the way we grow it matters.
Well, it seems like you're really doing a wonderful job of growing it. And you're also doing a wonderful job of marketing it. And you're also working on planning for the future. I don't know what more there is, but I sure appreciate having you both Bryce and Brita and Lundberg being on Farm to Table Talk. It's been a great conversation. Good luck with what you're doing. Come back and talk to us again sometime.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.